From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Think about all the ways you're prodded or poked or tapped throughout the day. The emails, the texts, the tweets, the alerts, links, tags, posts, pop-ups. Sure, this stuff is from the modern digital world, but William Powers says it's always been this way. Throughout history, he says, humankind has used new technologies to connect and then worried about what it all meant. In his book, Powers takes us on a tour of our technological past, and he focuses on the thinkers who tried to figure out the way forward. He calls them the seven philosophers of screens. Plato was among them. He worried about this stuff. So did Gutenberg and, of course, Shakespeare. The questions they were trying to figure out, and this is what the show is about today, is what happens when your life has become overwhelmed by a digital crowd and what you do to quiet your busy mind. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever feel a tinge of guilt when you pull out your smartphone on the sideline of your kid's soccer game? You ever feel the tug of some screen calling to you when you're out taking a walk? William Powers says you don't need to feel guilty. It's who we are. This impulse to connect to others is central to the human experience, he says. Powers has written a book that explores how you stay focused and present in a world of so many digital distractions. Humans, he says, love to journey outward. The question is, how do we get back? Because it's that return trip back to the life around us, back to our inner life, that gives that urge to connect on a screen some value and some meaning. Here's the essential idea of his book, which is called Hamlet's Blackberry. In order to lead a happy, productive life in a connected world, you've got to figure out the art of disconnecting. Today in the program, William Powers is joining us to talk about his book. The book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. William Powers has been a columnist and a media critic for The Washington Post, The New Republic, and National Journal. His book, by the way, is out in paperback, and William Powers is joining us from a studio on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. William Powers, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, I wanted to begin, as you do in the book, by setting this scene or establishing kind of this scenario that I think helps kind of put all of these ideas into context. Set this up for us, if you will, first, because you ask readers to imagine themselves being in this gigantic room.
Yes, I opened the book with a fictional metaphor, even though it's a nonfiction book, because I felt that we're so immersed in this digital life of ours that we've constructed in a relatively short time, just 15 years or so, that I wanted to step back and kind of give people a little perspective on it. So I asked the reader to imagine themselves being in a gigantic room that can hold a billion or more people, in which anyone in that room can come up to you at any moment and tap you on the shoulder to get your attention. And in fact, life in this room is basically a big nonstop festival of people tapping each other and trying to get each other's attention. And I then ask the reader to sort of, through a little story I tell about one person in that room, I ask the reader to imagine basically what it would be like to live there and both the benefits and joys that would come from that, but also the burdens that it might impose. And then I suggest that after living for a while in this room, you might actually want a little bit of a respite and perhaps a chance to find a door outside the room where you could escape for a little while, get some perspective and so forth. And I take them on a little journey where they're basically looking for a way to find that door.
I don't suppose we need to say too much about the condition of the digital era. I mean, it's a world, you say, in which everyone is connected to everyone else and all the time. And you say by now we're kind of used to all of this. This kind of the endless things that we can see and that we can do. And you write this, though. You say, sometimes, though, it feels like a paradise.
Yes. It's funny. You know, you say that about how we're used to this condition. It's funny. I wrote the book just a few years ago, and already in the couple years since I started writing the book, it's become even less necessary to tell people, you know, we're in this situation together.
It's just a given, right? Yeah.
Yeah. The whole opening of the book is kind of trying to wake people up to this situation. And now I realize if I were writing it again, I wouldn't actually have to do that at such length. But yes, so I do think in so many ways it's a paradise. I mean, I think about the things I can do in my own life, the people I can reach out to, the experiences I can have every day. I had some this morning, you know, reading a couple of incredibly surprising blogs online that I found out about through the people I follow on Twitter. Mm. And Twitter has become this incredibly rich part of my life because I follow these people with whom I share so much in terms of sensibility and interests, and I haven't met 99% of them. It's astonishing that I have connected to these people and they're feeding me all these great experiences. I tell some stories in the book about reaching out to people and having moments, including a rather extended one with my mother.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get to, by the way. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, how can you possibly argue with this structure we've built, this room, if you will, because we are closer in so many ways. And in fact, our lives are richer. But at the same time, and I don't know if you want me to go on to this point, but, you know, there's also a downside to having that much richness around you. And I think that's what we're grappling with. That's why I decided to write the book.
Well, it's the idea here is that there's this central conflict in the human experience. And it's one of those, as you write about in the book, it's one of those great themes in philosophy and literature and art. And it's that conflict between our inner selves, kind of our private inner lives, and our outer lives, our more social lives. And I guess we've always had that conflict throughout human history. We've always battled between those two parts of ourselves, I guess.
Yes, I mean, there's almost a cosmic question behind this. I actually tried to write what I'm about to say in the book, and it's one of those things that didn't work out, but I'm now wondering maybe it would have worked if I'd had this little three-sentence bit. But, you know, we're born, and our birth is really a disconnection. You know, the umbilical cord is cut. We were connected to someone, and it is severed. And we enter the world, and we're surrounded by all these other people who had that same experience when they first began. And in a sense, the rest of life is this effort to reconnect with others, you know, and with everything that is happening inside of them and everything that they know and all the things they can help us with. And so that's a beautiful thing. And to the extent that we succeed, it's fantastic. And we spend a lot of energy and we have over the centuries building devices to help us do that. So it all makes perfect sense. And that's why we're here and talking about Steve Jobs and all these people who've gotten us to that place, because it's sort of a triumph anytime we can do it.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about how we're always trying to find that balance between our inner lives and our outer lives. And you say it's shifted in our lifetimes. Right now, the outer world you talk about seems to be winning out. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what that means, because you say that rather than being directed by our own inner voice, more of what we're hearing is the voices of others.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so what happens is, you know, this cycle we're going through, I believe that it's a part of a technological revolution. And those don't happen all the time.
Yeah.
So we're living through an exceptional time, I think. And what happens is, my gosh, we have this whole new way of achieving that connectedness I just talked about, never before thought of, a miracle, you know, coming out of Silicon Valley and other places. And so we dive into that with great enthusiasm and energy and excitement, and we go to it. And I think, as happens with so many new things we discover in life, I mean, I'm thinking about adolescence and the discovery of love and sex and all these things that for the first time we're realizing, wow, this is awesome. We go a little overboard. And in this case, digital is able to, as I said with my own Twitter life, is able to feed us so many new voices and so much fascinating stuff and stuff that's useful that I think we lean that way. And in this case, you know, what I call the digital crowd in the book, all these voices have become really dominant in many of our lives because we're checking all day and we're constantly going back to the screen. What's the crowd saying now? Has anyone commented on my comments? You know,
right.
And that's, I think it's normal. As I said, it's part of this early period that we're in. And yet I do think we ultimately will move to a different place. And one of my goals in the book is to help us get there.
And the different place is for us to, there's this lovely image that comes toward the end of the book, and I can't remember exactly who the writer is that talked about it, but it's the idea of being alone but with someone.
Yes, alone but with someone. Yes, it's a, I can't remember his name either. It's a psychiatrist from the 20th century. It's the idea that you can be connected to the world and feel that connection and be drawing on it, actually, and yet be with yourself and actually doing something with all those things the world feeds you, doing something inwardly. You know, all that connectedness that we now can benefit from is only really reaching its fullest potential and expression if we take it inside each of us and reshape it and rework it and rethink it and come back to the world with something valuable and new. And so by leaning outward excessively and spending all our time out there in the crowd, I think in a way we're not only shortchanging ourselves experientially and so forth, but we're shortchanging the world.
Yeah.
We could actually be doing more if we make a point of stepping back, going inward with everything we've learned, like I did this morning from Twitter, and then returning in some way where we're contributing. And so I think that should be the cycle that we're aiming for.
So what is it then what is it that we're doing when we're tweeting and when we're – I mean, because it seems like you're saying it's more than us just sort of checking up with a particular blog we like, or it's more than just looking for the sports scores, because you raise the question in the book of whether – you know, our relationship with the digital sphere is about self-expression. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways, it seems that the possibilities to express ourselves on the internet, as you talk about, or in the digital universe, you know, is endless. The tweets and blogs and Facebook pages and these little mm-hmm. videos that we can make. But you seem to be saying that it's not just self-expression because it's taking place within the digital crowd. That's the thing that's framing it. That's the thing that's defining it. So we're not just expressing ourselves, we're doing what humans do. What? We're reaching out, right? Is that what it is?
We're reaching out and we're experiencing these other people. And I mean, you can't really sum up in a sentence what we're doing, but right. There's a kind of a spectrum of things. So at one end, say, I'm holding out my left hand here. At the left end of the spectrum, you might say there's the very practical stuff we get from connecting. We build our work lives. We figure out how to earn a living. We make connections that can be useful to us. We learn practical things that we can apply in our lives. Then you move a little bit closer to the middle of the spectrum. There's stuff that's just diverting and fun, and that kind of keeps the day interesting. I mean, the sports scores might qualify in that category. And then if you move further, now I'm holding out my right hand, you might get to the really spiritual dimension that connectedness also very much feeds and nourishes. And for that, I like to go to a little quote that Kurt Vonnegut used to say often. He used to say that every experience you have in life, ask yourself if it grows your soul. And if it's growing your soul, you should continue to do it. And I think we should be asking ourselves that question every day about digital life. To what extent is the way I'm organizing this life and sort of running my digital existence growing my soul? Because that's the ultimate in terms of not just selfish experience, but also the ability to, again, to contribute to others.
You want us in the book, it seems, to take responsibility for all of this. That seems important because you say mm-hmm. early on in the book, look, it's not technology's fault. I mean, we're the prime movers. We're always connected because we're always connecting. This is because mm-hmm. what we tend to kind of put off the responsibility for this, that it's our smartphone's fault or it's some – I mean, it's important for us to be accountable to the fact that this is you checking the screen. It's not right. It's not the smartphone's fault.
Yes, I mean there's always a temptation. Life is a challenge, and it requires a lot of us. And there's always a little dream we all have in our heart of hearts that it would just be easier, and we could just be carried along, you know,
yeah.
and not have to put our feet on the floor every morning and sort of put in so much effort to make it happen. And I think that any connective device has a way of feeding into that part of us, sort of a weaker part of us when we don't want to be self-reliant, and kind of suggests that maybe if I just give myself over to this thing, this crowd that's now surrounding me, I won't have to think so much and it won't be so hard. I feel that. I think everybody feels that every day. And one of my messages in the book, you're exactly right, is don't give into that.
Yeah.
You know, the real happiness, the real joy actually lies on the side of self-reliance and of being as much as you can be, and none of us can be completely, in control of your own fate and your own existence and really shaping it and really showing up for your life in the fullest sense of the word, because that is the best kind of life. You know, you can look back on the past week, the past month, the past decade, and realize, gosh, I really did that. You know, I did those things, and I created what I created. I had those experiences, and I did them because I decided to do it. I woke up in the morning and set out to do it, and it wasn't other people setting the agenda for me. And I find, even having written this book and been talking about it on the road and so forth, I find I still fall into that. My digital crowd is sort of running things for me and completely occupying my head. And I have to remind myself, no, you know, that's not the way to do it.
Bill Powers is with us. He's the author of Hamlet's Blackberry, A Practical Philosophy for Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a conflict going on in the era of emails and texts and tweets. It's this struggle between our desire to be connected and that impulse to be left alone. The writer and media critic William Powers says, it's always been this way. Throughout human history, we've fallen in love with technology but worried about what it means for our inner lives. Today in the program, Powers is joining us to talk about our technological past, how great thinkers in history have worked through this problem. His book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Bill Powers, there's this story that you tell in the book of a friend of yours, an immigrant to the United States. And you notice that whenever you saw her and you asked her how she was doing, she always had the same response. She said, what was it? Busy. I'm busy. I'm busy.
Busy, very busy.
Busy, very busy. That's right. Busy, right. Very busy. What did you learn from that? Because what you sort of came to realize was that she was copying what she was hearing from everybody else.
Right. So we have this friend, Marie, and this is in the 90s. She was a relatively recent arrival here. And we would say, run into her on the street, whatever, and she would say, how are you, Marie? And she'd, a big smile. And then she'd say, busy, very busy. Yeah. And I asked my wife, I said, what is up with Marie? She's always talking about how busy she is, but she seems to be incredibly happy that she's so busy. And after a while, and we actually sort of brought it up with her, we figured out that she actually thought that in America, that's what you say. That's how you say hello, because she heard everybody saying it constantly, how busy they were. And that stuck in my mind for years until I sat down to write the book as an emblem of really how we're living and maybe a problem that we have.
Well, this idea that busyness, as you say in the book, busyness itself seems to be the point.
Yes. It's as if, I mean, I was thinking about this just this morning, actually, on my way over here. I was thinking about busyness as a way we kind of trick our souls, to go back to what I said about growing your soul. We trick our souls into thinking we're doing fine in life. You know, everything must be fine because I'm so busy. And there's a lot happening around me. Therefore, I'm okay. You know, I've got people care about me, and I've got stuff going on in my life, and I don't have an empty life. And yet, there's a funny way in which you get so busy and so run by your busyness, and a lot of it you can't avoid, obviously, work and family obligations and so forth. But a lot of it is, I think, self-generated. We throw in a lot of optional busyness to the mix. And what happens is, you know, you become such a prisoner of your busyness that it's an emptier life than if you had no busyness. You know, it's a whole other kind of emptiness that is a real problem. And I think this is one of the dangers of this particular point in the digital age where we use the devices simply to play that trick on ourselves so that we feel busy and therefore everything must be okay. And sort of like, I don't have to think anymore, you know, and I don't have to try.
Yeah.
And that is a problem.
Well, you say this whole idea of busyness kind of leads us to, I guess, what is kind of the biggest question we confront. Is this what I want with my life? You know, why am I here? Who am I? I mean, that's contained in that idea, it seems.
Yes. I mean, it's a very easy and convenient way to define yourself. You just define yourself in a very practical way by all this stuff that's happening to you during the day. But I really emphasized when I said that passive formation happening to you because you're not really necessarily driving it or making it happen or kind of you know, in the driver's seat of your life if you're living that way. Busyness can be exhilarating. And some of my happiest times in life have been on deadline, not just for this book but for other things, when I had way too many things to do. And there's this incredible feeling, if you have a mission, of busyness being great. But there's another kind that I see all the time in my own life and in others' lives, which is this sort of pointless busyness for its own sake because it was there. And that's the thing, one of my messages in the book, is that we should really be careful in this time when we really now can be busy all the time and be following anybody's life anywhere in the world all the time and being tapped on the shoulder all the time. We have to be careful not to go to that place.
Let's take a call from Peter. Peter's joining us in Park City, Utah. Peter, welcome.
The first comment was, the author was searching for the name of the psychiatrist that said living with couples, actually referred to married couples, was learning to live alone together. The psychiatrist's name was Semrad. He was a very great book written by his students in honor of him. But my comment or question is, for me, being connected is more about being with others physically in the present. That's what makes me feel satisfied about human relationships. And all of the digital stuff, while I find it great, it's informative, I learn a lot, I have to admit the tweeting thing and the blogging thing hasn't happened for me. I don't find that that really fulfills that human need that I have to be with others. And I just was wondering what the author had to say.
Peter, thanks very much. I should mention, by the way, William Powers, that I think you were thinking of Donald Winnicott.
Yes, I just looked it up myself. Yeah, okay, it was. But that other person sounds interesting. I should start reading him as well.
Right.
Well, it's a great question, Peter. I do share a lot of thoughts about physical togetherness in the book, and I really am on your side on that. I think there's a richness to being physically with people. Frankly, it's a richness of information. You can get so much information from eye contact and intonation and what one philosopher called the grain of the voice. Mm. The human voice really does have a grain that you can read in person better than even on the phone. So all those things are true. But I do think in an age of a new technology, there is a way in which some of us, and I have been in this category myself, you can tell from what I just said, some of us tend to discount the new one because it's not replicating the older one in certain ways, you know. So obviously digital isn't the same as physical togetherness. But in every case of a powerful new technology, the printing press, the telegraph, you name it, there is a way in which it's adding something valuable to the mix. And it's very, very valuable, I think, to be open to that and to, in a sense, pay extra attention to what's the added value. I believe in human beings and their general tendencies to go for things that are worthwhile in the long run. Therefore, in my view, there has to be a reason why we're having this digital craze. Something great is being added that we're only beginning to understand. And so while physical togetherness, I think, will always be at the top of the list, there is something special in all these tools, and I have certainly found it in Twitter, that I would urge you to really look at and maybe give a second try to, because it can really bring a lot into your life.
This is a good segue to get us into the way we've thought about all of this throughout history. I want to get to Plato, because it seems this idea of distance is something that Plato really thought a lot about. But let me ask you this anyway about the idea of using history. It's important to say, as you do in the book, that this isn't exactly uncharted territory. Humankind, you know, we've been here before. We've had new technologies that connected us, and it seems like we always worry about it. We always think, what is this doing to us? That's kind of a theme, it seems, throughout history.
It is, and I was surprised to learn in working on the book, I didn't realize how much of a theme it was among philosophers per se.
Yeah.
But it turns out it comes up a lot. Sometimes you have to read closely because there might be a piece of philosophy, for example, in Plato, where people haven't focused on that part of the message. But it was really there, and I tried to highlight some of those for my readers.
Well, let's start with Plato. And as you say, one of his greatest dialogues, really. And it comes from this story. It's this beautiful summer day in Athens, and Plato's teacher, Socrates, sees this young man that he knows, and he calls to him. That's kind of the beginning of this scenario that you work through. Take it from there, if you would, William Powers.
Yeah, so Socrates calls out to this young student of his, Phaedrus, and he says, what are you up to, Phaedrus? Why are you walking around the city streets? And Phaedrus says, oh, I've just heard this incredible speech. And, of course, in Athens at this time, late 4th century B.C., there was a lot of public speaking as one of the main forms of education, entertainment. It was what people did to learn and to connect. So he just heard this great speech, and he's basically trying to memorize it as he walks down the streets. And he says, I'm about to go outside the city walls into the countryside because a doctor friend of mine has told me that's refreshing for the mind to do that. And so I'm going to go out and think about this speech. Will you come with me? And Socrates says, no. He doesn't say no. He says he agrees to go with him. But as they're walking along, he kind of reveals that he's been very reluctant to go out in the countryside because the countryside has no use for him. Mm-hmm. He loves being in the city where people are having conversations all the time, which, of course, is his favorite form of connection. You know, Socrates invented the Socratic method, which is conversation. So already they're having a conversation about connectedness as they walk along. And they finally get to this place by a stream where they have this long, amazing, multi-layered conversation about practically every question you can imagine, from love and sex to the afterlife to really the meaning of life, all as they basically sit by this stream. And at a certain point in the conversation, they begin talking about tools of connectedness, and in particular this new one that has just arrived in popular use in Greece, which is the alphabet. Written language has just begun to take off in a popular way. It had been around for centuries, but it was now beginning to be used by everybody. And they start to talk about this tool of connectedness, the idea of writing letters down, because Socrates' whole life, it's been all about oral conversation. In fact, he can't even read. And the student, Phaedrus, pulls out one of these tools he has hidden under his cloak, a scroll, right, with actually a written version of the speech he just heard. And Socrates reveals in the course of an exchange they have about the alphabet that he is dead set against that tool. He thinks that writing is going to destroy the human mind, destroy the imagination, destroy creativity. And basically he says, in a very Socratic, beautiful way, he says, steer clear of that. It's really bad for us. And he even tells a kind of a mythical story about why it's bad for us. And so it's a fascinating case of this great connector, one of the legendary connectors of all time, really not getting what turned out to be one of the most amazing tools of all time that, of course, led to books and all these great things we have. At the same time, the other reason I told the story, they managed to have this incredible connection because they put a little distance between themselves and the busy, busy world of Athens where all that conversation was happening. So the story is also about the importance of stepping back from your connectedness. So it's sort of a multi-layered story, but I hope the reader would get sort of the double and triple meanings.
Well, it's interesting. Plato revered, of course, Socrates, but you know, he wrote this down, so he must have believed in the idea that writing things down was a way to experience ideas, but at a distance.
The other great little ending to the story is that, you know, the reason we have this beautiful dialogue that is taught everywhere in the world today is that Plato basically violated Socrates' advice and wrote it down for us to have. So he clearly was on to, we don't know much about Plato, but he clearly saw there's going to be some long-term value in this tool. I'm going to use it. And Plato himself, to take the other principle about distance, Plato himself later in his life, after Socrates was dead, started his famous academy in the very same countryside outside Athens, which he clearly realized was a place to get a little bit of distance for learning and thinking and basically going to a new place with all those wonderful ideas that were flying around the city.
Back to the phones. Jennifer is with us in Vernal. Jennifer, hi.
Hi there. I've tried to reduce the number of words in my question, so it now reads. And wasn't it Mark Twain who said, I'm sorry about the long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Anyway.
Somebody, anyway.
So my question is, have you come up with or come across, and you have to understand, I haven't seen this book yet, okay, a system for prioritizing incoming information?
Well,
on the screen.
Yeah. I mean, William Powers, we're going to get to some of the guidelines that you talk about in the book itself. But you want to address that?
Yes. Well, I will say, before we get to any specifics to Jennifer, that it is always, I think, for all of us, a work in progress, this ability, you know, this desire we have to prioritize and make sense of it all. I'm constantly working on it. In fact, just in the last week, I've stumbled on a new sort of email program that was embedded in my computer. I didn't even realize it, that helped me combine my various email accounts in one so I could then flag things in a different way. So I'm constantly using not only willpower, which is a big part of my book, but also the tools themselves. And I think, in fact, that the tools, one of the themes in the book is that the tools themselves should be evolving now to help us get better at prioritizing and organizing and finding spaces of relative disconnectedness. I think they will head in that direction, though it seems at the moment they're going in the opposite. So it's basically a work in progress for me, and I'm constantly on top of it.
Jennifer, thanks. This idea of distance is important, and it's this notion of a gap comes up in a story you tell, where you're working us through this idea of, you know, just where does this urge to connect, you know, come from? Why is there this urgency? And you tell the story about this kind of simple phone call you have with your mom that gives you this really powerful revelation. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, so I tell this story that had stuck in an incident that from my life that had stuck in my mind for a couple of years by the time I wrote the book, and I realized it therefore had some meaning. And since it was about my phone, my cell phone, I thought I should explore it. I was driving to visit my mom. She lives a couple hours away. I go there often because she lives near the airport that I fly out of. So we will have this little ritual where we have dinner and then I go catch my flight. Or, you know, I'll stay over and catch it the next morning. In any case, I was on the way and I realized I was running late as usual. So I called her on the phone to just tell her I'm late. Can you hold dinner? And she said, yes, of course, as usual.
Right.
And we hung up. It was kind of like a nothing phone call if you think about it. The only thing remarkable about it was that I was able to make it from the car, moving at, you know, 55 miles an hour, perhaps not safely, although it is legal in Massachusetts. And 20 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So that's an example of this technology taking us to a place. But after I hung up the phone, I looked at the little picture I have of her that comes up when I'm talking to her. And as I saw it vanish from the screen and I put the phone in the cup holder, this other thing happened in the car as I drove along. Something about the picture and having heard my mother's voice, all these memories of her sort of rose up out of my, whatever you want to call it, the hard drive of my mind, you know, all these memories I would file under mom were sort of dancing around me in the car, just little moments of her walking across the grass, laughing over a story I heard, just typical mom things. And literally for 15 minutes or so driving along, I had this intense period of connectedness with my mom that has fascinated me ever since because, A, it was all enabled by the device, by the cell phone, another example of how rich they can, how much they can enrich our lives. But B, it only happened because when I was done speaking to her, I put the phone away and I didn't move on to another call or some other task. I didn't keep myself busy in the way that digital devices allow us to keep ourselves busy all the time. I let a little bit of a gap open up between myself and my connected life, and that's where all the good stuff was. Mm. That's where it all happened. So I use that as a metaphor for this notion of gaps and how not just important they are, I think really essential to getting the most out of life in a connected world. It's an irony that to connect well, you have to learn how to disconnect, but I think it's the irony we need to all come around to and embrace because it's going to make life so much better in this world we're building.
So but how does that like practically translate? Does it mean, all right, just stop thinking, stop moving on to the next. Give yourself 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. The time of the gap doesn't matter, but that you have a gap, that you have a moment of reflection that you take from the screen. That's the point, right?
Well, that's the basic point. But if you think about it, there's all kinds of ways that that point can be translated into action and into how we live each day. So, for example, I just mentioned with the last caller, the tools, you know, not necessarily helping us today in terms of focus. And when you think about it, you know, a lot of these Facebook and Twitter and all these tools that we use a lot now are currently designed, really consciously designed. So more things are constantly interrupting and scrolling and things are moving down the screen and giving you new distractions and so forth. That's taking you to the opposite place of the gap that I'm talking about. Mm. Why do they have to be structured that way? Why can't our tools, digital tools, be structured so they afford and enable focus? You know, the kind of focus that we have enjoyed for centuries with a book, for example. Mm. You know, books are wonderfully engineered to enable focus. Human beings don't come by focus naturally. It's something we had to learn, scientists tell us, over thousands of years, learn to focus and not be short attention span creatures. These digital tools can do that too, and we just have sort of lost track of how important it is. So there's all kinds of expressions of that very simple principle. I do think that many of the most powerful ideas that can help us in life are simple, and that's why I just tried to reduce, or I did reduce it to a three-letter word, gap. You know, there's something about thinking about the gap and applying it in all kinds of ways that I think can be very helpful to us as we move forward.
Here's an email from Ryan, who writes from Salt Lake City. Much of what I see and feel in regards to connecting via the technological world is in the service of ego. Who doesn't like feeling relevant by getting an email, Ryan writes. But in the subconscious mind, we're all connected anyway. How ironic it is that we've embraced ego-driven technologies to feel connected when under the surface we already are. All it takes, he writes, is a blankness of mind to get to it.
Well, very nice thought. I really played around with – I'm fascinated by the ego aspect of these tools, and I touch on it a couple times in the book, but not in quite the way that email does. And the reason is I made a decision in the book to go with Western philosophers and not include the Eastern philosophers, whom I also read a lot and am a big fan of. Particularly Zen is very good at talking about this problem of the ego and the bad place it can take you to if you just allow the ego to run your life. The reason I went for the Western philosophers is that I really wanted the book to feel accessible and not a intimidating book for people living everyday digital lives. I was writing it for an American audience, and I felt like, okay, I'm going to stick with our own tradition because it has something to say about this. If I had turned eastward in the book, I would have had a lot more about what he raises in that email because it's massive. The ego yeah. taking over your existence and forgetting about the power of that blankness is one of the biggest mistakes we can make, I think.
Ryan, thanks very much. And Jennifer, thanks to you. Also, Peter, we're talking with Bill Powers about his book, Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with William Powers. We're talking about his book, Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. And Bill Powers is joining us today from a studio in Cape Cod in Massachusetts. So I wanted to ask you about the Roman philosopher Seneca. He's one of one of these that you write about. What is it that he saw? What was the technology that he saw that was burdening him? Because he thought a lot about this idea of connectedness, and he came up with this idea of inner distance, is how you put it. Talk about Seneca. Mm-hmm.
Well, there were a couple of things that Seneca noticed. But first, let me say about Seneca, what's interesting about him and useful is that he was one of the busiest people on the planet at the time he was alive.
Right.
He wasn't just a philosopher. He was a senator and a very successful politician who for a while, a period of about 6 years, was effectively the emperor of Rome because it was the boy emperor at the time, Nero. Mm. And Seneca basically was brought in to run things. So he was – it doesn't get any busier than that. And it's interesting, you know, somebody in power like that who's very, very busy and is also a philosopher, he had really amazing writings about this, in particular a series of letters that I draw on. And basically, Seneca was wrestling with a couple of things. One was the tool that Socrates had such concerns about, the alphabet, had exploded in the time between the height of Athens and Seneca's lifetime. And now written language was everywhere. Books were being put out at an astonishing rate in ancient Rome. It was impossible to keep up with what we would call the bestsellers of the time. There was paperwork, there were documents, especially for somebody living Seneca's life. So there was a lot of text to keep up with. But second, Seneca was also dealing with what we wouldn't necessarily consider a technology, but it was a form of connectedness, which was empire itself. What the Romans did was really pull the world together in a new way through roads and postal systems and these cities that, in particular Rome itself, that grew up in the empire and that were amazing engines of connectedness. And he was very eloquent about both the upside of that kind of life and all the things you can gain from it, but also the burden it can impose, and not just the practical burden of being too busy, but really a spiritual and a moral burden. He talks at one point about he and his friends suffering from what he calls the restless energy of a hunted mind. Yeah. And I came across that, and my wife was next to me in bed when I was reading it, and I turned to her and I said, listen to this. The restless energy of a hunted mind, what does that remind you of? And she said, us. And she didn't know I was reading a letter 2,000 years old. And that was actually the beginning of my deciding to include these philosophers from long ago in the book, because I realized, you know, in many ways things haven't changed so much and we've always been wrestling with this. And Seneca is not only eloquent about it, but practical. He talks about exercises he used and so forth. And he's also funny. He had a sense of humor about it, and he was capable of laughing at himself.
And the idea of these social groups connecting up with, you know, the big ones and the more intimate ones, that seems to be something you took from Seneca.
Yes, you mean the outward world impinging on the inner?
Yeah.
The closer, intimate world. Yes, yes. I mean, he talks about he tells great stories that I don't have time to recount here, but I give a taste of them in the book of people being such hostages to this sense of the crowd, the importance of the crowd. He tells one, I'll just tell in a couple sentences, of a guy who, in his society in Rome, who used to throw these dinner parties where he wanted to impress everyone with how up he was on all the latest books. And it was impossible to keep up, as I said, so he bought a dozen slaves and assigned each one of those slaves the sole task of memorizing all the works of a popular writer. Each one had a different writer. And they would then whisper to him in his ear at dinner little quotes he could spout, so he seemed as if he'd read the books.
Wow.
So it was sort of like a human Google. Amazing that someone would be so concerned about touting their own connectedness to the world outside that they would let it, in a sense, come between them and real intimacy with the people around them and authentic, you know, connection. But that's what this fellow did. So Seneca's full of stories like that about how important it is to not let that happen. And he was really a progenitor of what Thoreau talked about, self-reliance, the importance of the self-reliant life and the life that is as simplified as you can make it, because that's where all the richness is.
William Powers is with us. Hamlet's Blackberry is the name of his book, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. Back to the phone. Steve is with us in Charleston, West Virginia. Steve, welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
I have a question for both of you. You talked earlier with one of your callers about your desire, your motivation to work in progress. I guess that's your entire lives you're talking about, or not just your career, but everything you're involved with. I wonder what motivates you, what drives you to feel a need to continue to learn and to share and things like that in your life, personal and professional.
Good question.
Yeah. connected to the book, William Powers, can you? I mean, this idea, I guess it is about connectedness, is about, as we said earlier, the essence of some of those bigger questions in life. What am I doing with my life?
Yes. I mean, when I used that phrase earlier, I was really talking about just how I organize my screen life, and that's always a work in progress. But the caller's exactly right. I mean, I think that the happiest people I know, who I try to model myself on, view each day as a chance to chip away a little bit more at the work in progress that is their lives, and to do so in a conscious way, you know, to try and be more alive each day, more human each day, because none of us ever completely gets there, you know, to whatever would be the ultimate state of being alive. We're always trying. And I think that these tools can be an incredible help in that, an incredible assist. I mean, as I said at the top of the conversation, I had a couple of brief experiences via Twitter today that took me to a more human place and made my work in progress really so much better. I started the day that way. It doesn't always happen in the morning, but it started the day, and it happened because of my digital tools. So I find it inspiring and enriching to use this kind of connectedness to get to that place, but also to remember that it's not the only way to be inspired. It's not the only way to move forward. And in fact, if you become a hostage to these tools, you can move backward and go in the other direction. And so it's that magic word balance that we have to keep in mind.
Steve, thanks very much. Well, we've got to talk about Shakespeare, and the compelling term in the title, of course, comes from Shakespeare, this Elizabethan version of a BlackBerry. It was an actual piece of technology. I have to say I had no idea, Bill Powers, about this. Shakespeare gives this piece of technology to the Prince of Denmark, of course, in the play Hamlet. Mm-hmm. Talk about this. These are his tables.
Yes, his tables. It's a little confusing because it's this plural word for a singular gadget, but it was a gadget that was very popular in Shakespeare's lifetime. It was relatively new. It was a little, like, kind of a booklet that you could open up, carry in your pocket, and when you wanted to use it, you opened up and there was a surface on it that you could write on. It wasn't paper. It was a kind of a plaster-like surface, and you wrote on it with a stylus, a metal stylus, just like the ones we see today. And the whole purpose of these tables was to really help people organize their lives, their work in progress, if you will, as they went through the day. So write down to-do lists, names of people they'd run into, things they wanted to remember, and so forth. But the magic of the tables that had never really existed before was that you could erase it with a swipe of your finger or of a little cloth, and make everything you'd written on it go away. And in a time of a tech revolution, really, that Shakespeare lived through, the print revolution, when the whole world seemed to be filling up with too much information, taking up space, piling up around you, this was a way of creating information, keeping it for as long as it was useful, and then making it vanish with a swipe. It was a wonderful thing. People wrote in their journals and letters about how addicted they were to their tables. The philosopher Montaigne said that he couldn't get through a conversation without having his tables in one hand, which is so analogous to us and our smartphones.
Yeah.
When I came across this story, I just knew, you know, oh my gosh, this is Hamlet had a BlackBerry. I have to use that in the book somehow, and ultimately it became the title.
Well, you write about how these older technologies can help ground a busy mind. And you say, don't assume that the newest tools are always the best choice for any given task.
Yes. So that is an aspect of this story that I explore in that chapter, which is that, you know, this tool used handwriting in the age of print. Mm-hmm. And as print was exploding in Shakespeare's time, a lot of people felt handwriting might become obsolete. Who needs handwriting when you can have everything printed out so clearly and everyone's going to have a printing press someday and so forth? And it turned out that handwriting was even more useful than it had ever been, precisely because of the birth of print, because handwriting was a way of personalizing the print revolution and really taking it into your own life in a special way and taking the information you really wanted and saving it. So I use that principle to remind people that these old tools that we dismiss that are still with us, including, frankly, paper books and hard copy newspapers and so forth, they do have some enduring uses and in some ways have become more useful because they're little islands of disconnectedness within our lives. They may not be with us forever, but I think we should cherish them and use them while they're here because they have a way of moderating and bringing down to earth this revolution, which can sometimes feel like it's making our heads spin.
I think time for one more call. Stefan is with us in Brigham City. Stefan, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
It's great to be on. I have a question I've been wanting a long time to ask somebody. Is there something wrong with me? I have no interest in Facebook or Twitter or any of the social media, and there's other people I know that are addicted and they can't stay away from it. And I feel a lot of times overwhelmed by this anxiety that there's something wrong with me because I don't want this kind of interaction. The time I have spent on Facebook, there's so much information and so many people are doing everything, and I just want to shut that all out. Am I putting myself at a big disadvantage by not engaging in this?
What is wrong with Stefan, William Powers?
Yeah. I love this question, Stefan. Thank you. I don't think there's anything wrong with you. I think that there's a kind of a big, broad continuum of personality types that we all fall on to some extent. Some people have called it, you know, the introvert-extrovert continuum or spectrum, and I do think that we all have different tendencies and needs. And one way of looking at it is that people who are more introverted, which is they enjoy quiet time, they enjoy inward time more than they enjoy social time, are less likely to want to use these tools. On the other hand, there is evidence that people who are introverted, some of them, are particularly drawn to these tools because they are a way of being social without really having to be with people. So it cuts in many different directions. But I think, you know, my basic message to you is that if you're happy staying off these new tools and don't feel like anything's missing other than you're not doing what everybody else is doing, I say go with it. You know, why would you want to add something that gives you that feeling when you look at it the first time, feels too busy for you, too much happening? And there's no reason to feel anxious about going your own way, because if it's your own way, that's the whole point of all of this stuff, is to find your own way, carve out your place in life that really works for you and that feels fulfilling and satisfying. And so I say wait for the digital tool to come along that does serve your interests. And I bet one is on the way sooner or later that will appeal to you. We may just be at a moment when these tools of busyness are too busy for you. And in that sense, you sound like a very wise man.
That's Bill Powers. His book is called Hamlet's Blackberry, Building a Good Life in the Digital Age. He joined us from a studio on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. Bill Powers, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. It was a great pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. Our thanks to Tim Slover. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.